All right. So thank you very much. This is, I told her at Greenberg, I have a launch program tonight at the Bayou. We're doing kind of an opening program for the year there. And I'm hoping that we get a turnout like this, over there. This is very nice. I should have maybe talked about autopsy there. The topic for today, is medical ethics, autopsy, and cremation. In case anyone is curious about the next session, the next one is on October 26th, and it is Are You My Mother? Surrogacy, cloning, and all sorts of other questions which it raises. Okay. So I thought that we would start out with autopsy. I know that some people have to leave at about 1:15, so I figure we'll be able to probably tackle the autopsy topic by 1:15, and then anyone who can stay for the rest will be able to hear about cremation. Autopsy is really the bigger question. Some of the issues I want to talk about, obviously, within autopsy are, when are you allowed to do it, when are you not allowed to do it, if you're going to do it, how do you do it? And then within cremation, I think, as someone said to me as I was coming in a few minutes ago, well, isn't it obvious we don't cremate? The answer is yes, we don't cremate. But the question is, there are a lot of issues that come up surrounding it. For example, before I moved to Toronto, I was the rabbi of a community in Pennsylvania, and quite frequently we would get the question of, my so-and-so, my mother, my father, my brother, whatever it is, asked to be cremated. We'd like to have a tahara from the Chevra Kedisha. The Chevra Kedisha should prepare the body before the cremation. So would we actually do that? Or someone's already been cremated, will we bury the ashes in a Jewish cemetery? So there are all sorts of questions that come up. So by way of introducing the autopsy topic, it's worth knowing that classically, historically, going back a couple of thousand years, nobody did autopsies. It was considered taboo in general. The Greeks banned it, the Romans banned it, India, China, Syria, no one was doing autopsy. King Ptolemy in the 4th century before the Common Era permitted a couple of autopsies for medical studies. Galen, if you've learned about Galen as pretty much the father of medicine, in the 2nd century before the Common Era only saw a human skeleton once in his entire career. In Alexandria, he found a body and he saw the skeleton, and that was how he looked at it. That's how he learned everything he learned. Other than that, he found decomposed bodies in the Tiber River and took whatever information he could get. It's not until the 13th century that you actually have systematic autopsy. Now, in the Gemara itself, you actually have autopsy happen. A couple of cases. One is the Gemara that talks about a woman the king had ordered executed, and the sages actually had an autopsy done in order to learn the different parts of the body, because it does matter in Jewish thought for certain issues. One is an issue of purity and impurity. I'm not going to go into that in depth right now, but they did autopsy for that. Cleopatra had servants who she ordered executed, and they actually studied their bodies, and some of them were pregnant, and so they learned embryology from studying the bodies of these women and the fetuses that were inside them. So you had a concept of autopsy. Autopsy did take place. The question is, what's the justification, and could it be done today? By the way, if you want to interrupt me at some point to ask a question, please do. It's fine. I don't mind. I actually enjoy not lecturing for 45 minutes straight. So if you want to at some point, just interject. You have a gap from the Gemara's time until basically the 18th century in which autopsy isn't really discussed. You don't have debates about to do it, not to do it. And the reason, again, is secular society isn't doing it. There's no pressure to do it. It only comes up in the 18th century where doctors start to practice autopsy to learn things, and the Jewish community ends up with the question of, can you actually do an autopsy? So, for example, Rabbi Chezkel Landau was asked in the 18th century about a case in London, England, in which they wanted to examine someone who had undergone a kidney stone surgery, and the surgery had failed, and so they wanted to examine him to find out what went wrong. So he was asked about that. In 1836, the Chassam Sofer, Moshe Sofer, writing in Pressburg in Hungary, is asked about somebody who wants to will his body for a scientific examination. Is that permitted? And that opens up a fountain of literature so that every major authority from the Chassam Sofer forward deals with this question of, may we do autopsy in particular for medical study? Interestingly, Rabbi Avram Steinberg put together the Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Ethics. And in his article on autopsy, he claims that Hebrew University's medical school was delayed. They wanted to found a medical school at Hebrew University in 1925. And it was delayed until 1947 because of debates about cadavers and autopsy, because of this issue. It's a very hot issue. Now, the truth of the matter is that the issue is now in decline. I don't know how many of you are medical students at all. Planning to be medical students? We have a couple? Okay. So the tendency today, not within Judaism, but in general society, is not really to recommend autopsy in most cases. Cases where they would do it sort of routinely 20 years ago, they don't do it anymore. And there are a few reasons for that. One reason is because non-invasive procedures have improved. We have MRIs and the like that you can do a lot of investigation without opening up the body. Another, this is one for the lawyers, the doctors are afraid because the more you look, the more likely it is that you find evidence of malpractice. So the doctors are uncomfortable with the idea that we're now going to recommend that we do research on a body and potentially find something that's a problem. Also, studies have shown autopsy does not seem to actually improve our medical knowledge. The general rate of incorrect diagnoses does not go down in communities where autopsy is done. And then finally, and perhaps the big reason, is that insurance won't reimburse for it. So the result of this is that autopsy is recommended less and less from a medical standpoint. Well, you do tend to see it, and from my own experience, autopsy tends to be found, number one, for criminal reasons, where they're afraid that a crime took place and they want to investigate and do it for forensic purposes. That's one. And the other is if they're concerned about some kind of a congenital disease in a family, and there are siblings and they want to know, so well, what do we have to worry about for the siblings? Is there something wrong in the heart? Something along those lines. So that's just introduction on where autopsy is. It will probably not come as a surprise. I hope it doesn't come as a surprise. That from a traditional Jewish outlook, the human body has to be treated with respect. Okay. Is there any surprise on that? No. I hope. Okay. Just checking. And because of that, we don't want to do anything that's going to degrade the body. Now, this respect is on many levels. On one level, we value the body because it contributes to mitzvot. I can only do good deeds because I have a body to carry it out. My soul can want to all at once, but that isn't what does it. So the Gemara Menachos talks about Rabbi Akiva and the way his body was mutilated by the Romans after he died, and the horror Moses sees. He has a vision of what happens to Rabbi Akiva, and he protests to God and he says, "Can this be? That's what's going to happen to the body of somebody who taught Torah." His complaint is, this body did mitzvot, how can you degrade it? And it's Menachos, it's 29b for anyone who wants to look it up. And that's one reason. A stronger reason that's brought is the honor of God. If you take a look at source number one, the Torah instructs us, Al tishaktsu es nafsho seichem, do not render your lives disgusting. Now, what does that mean? Don't render your lives disgusting. So the sages took that to mean, you have to treat your body with respect. Don't do anything which will make your body repellent. And repellent is very subjective. It's going to depend on what people consider repellent. But don't do anything that's going to make your body disgusting. That's the basic principle. So take a look at the Rambam and what he does with that in source number two. The Rambam writes, Asrum chachamim ma'achalos u'mashkin shnefesh rov b'nei adam kei ha-mehen. He says, the sages prohibited food and drink that repulse most people, such as food and drink with vomit or excrement, foul liquids, or similar things mixed in. And so the sages prohibited eating and drinking from dirty utensils, which repulse a person. Right? Next time you go into some cafeteria somewhere, and the stuff, you know, the equipment's dirty, you have to tell them. The Rambam says I'm not allowed to use that. Such as bathroom utensils, the glass utensils of barbers, which they used to draw blood, of course, in the Rambam's day, 900 years ago, the barbers are multi-purpose. The barbers aren't just barbers, they're also bloodletters. And they also prohibited eating with dirty, filthy hands or on dirty cloths. For all of these are included in, you shall not render your lives disgusting. Sorry about the typo. One who eats thus is whipped with lashes of rebellion. The court will actually give a person lashes. Lashes of rebellion are subject to the rabbi's discretion on the court. They can choose to give it or not to give it. but what he doesn't mention here, but I always found interesting, when we learned about this first in school, it became a tool for us, was that the, you already know what I'm talking about, the included in this prohibition is that a person who has to go use the washroom is not allowed to wait. He's supposed to go use it right away. So we, of course, use that in the classroom when the teacher didn't want to let us out. What am I supposed to do? It's a mitzvah. This is a divine gift. The body is a divine gift to a person, and it remains in that status of God's gift to us even afterwards. Even after a person passes away, that's our responsibility. And you can see it if you take a look at source number 3. The Torah talks about executing a criminal. Now, it's very hard to execute a criminal in Jewish law. You may be familiar with some of the restrictions involved. In order to be able to execute somebody, you first need to prove, number one, that the person did it. You require... you first require You first require two witnesses to testify that they saw the person do it. Those witnesses are cross-examined 20 different ways to ensure they actually saw what they said they saw. Biblically, we are told that the court is obligated to try to find the defendant innocent. So they're obligated to try to interrogate the witnesses until they can find a hole in their case or get the witnesses to contradict themselves. We're told that if the court decides 23-0, there are 23 judges on the court. You can imagine getting 23 judges to agree on anything, but there are 23 judges on the court. And if they decide 23-0 on day one that this person is guilty, then we let him off. Because the assumption is they didn't try hard enough to find him innocent. That means, you know, someone goes out to Rogers Stadium and shoots somebody there with 30,000 people watching, and so the court says, well, obviously he did it. If the court makes the mistake of voting 23-0 on their first vote, we throw the case out, the guy goes free. It's very hard to execute somebody, and in addition to all of this, you require intent. The person has to be warned before he does it. Don't do that, and if you do that, you get the death penalty, and the person has to say, I understand, and I'm doing it on those terms. A little hard to carry out a death penalty. Yes?
Good question. If you disprove the witness's testimony, does that make them zoning and you have to kill them?
So only if you disprove it in certain ways. You need witnesses to prove that they were, that when they say this event happened, you say you saw this on Wednesday at 3 o'clock, you were in fact with me across town. Because you need to prove that it was intentional, that they were actually plotting to do this.
Otherwise, you just throw out their testimony.
Otherwise, you just throw out the testimony, defendant walks. That's correct. So, when it comes to the reason I stress all of this is because that's the context for the following line in the Torah. The person who we actually managed to execute, which is fairly rare, one of the sages said once in 70 years, but if you manage to do it, after the execution, they would leave the body out, leaned against a board. And the idea was for people to see and understand, look what happens, look what the penalty is. But you shall not leave his body upon the wood, you shall bury it that day, for this is blasphemy when it is suspended. There are numerous ways that this passage is taken in the Torah, but the simple and straightforward read is that it's blasphemy to God for this person's body to be on display. Why is it blasphemy to God if this body is on display? Your turn. What's the big deal? It's God's creation, correct. We are created in the image designated for us by God. You put this person out there, it's a desecration of that image and therefore of God. The body is said to represent God in this world. So because of that, I'm not going to do anything that's going to degrade it. Yes?
But why didn't anyone say to do it at all?
Right.
It would be like you executed the creature.
Right, so why are we doing this to the body at all? The answer seems to be we have competing imperatives here, much as we do in every ethical case. On the one hand, we don't want this body left out. On the other hand, we want to make sure that this is a lesson to everybody, hey, God is serious. If you commit certain crimes.
There's like an execution going on, and there's no the body is sitting there. Like everyone like knows.
Right.
You know, that's what happens.
Because they weren't texting 2,000 years ago. Right? I mean, how did you get your information? You weren't allowed to delay the execution. It wasn't as though you judged the person, found them guilty, said, okay, now we're gonna punish them, and we're gonna set an execution date in 2 weeks. That was called Inui Hadin. That would be oppressing the victim. It's bad enough he's getting killed. You can't oppress him. It's cruel. So therefore, they would have to execute right away. Now, they waited one day. There was a possibility for judges to change their mind, but you were doing it fairly quickly, so people didn't necessarily hear, and it's a very rare event. It isn't something that would happen normally. So that's the second reason why we make sure not to degrade the body. It's God's gift, and it represents God. And then third of three reasons is the honor of human beings themselves. Meaning, when I degrade two parts. I'm going to go with one part first. When I degrade the body, we are taught that the soul actually feels it. There's a connection, body and soul, that doesn't end, we're taught, when the person passes away. If you take a look at source number 4, comment from the Gemara building on a sentence from Iyo, from Job. Kasha rima lemeis kemachad bebasar hachai. Decay in a corpse is as harsh as a needle in flesh of the living. Meaning the same way it hurts if you stab someone with a needle, the body is pained, the soul is pained if the body is suffering. And they quote the sentence in Eo, but his flesh will pain him and his soul will mourn for him, describing after a person dies. That doesn't mean that there are nerve connections between the body and the soul. I don't believe that that's what we're suggesting here. Rather, the soul inhabits the body and becomes close to it over the course of a lifetime and is aware of what's going on after death, and it's upsetting to see yourself, because really that's the way we perceive ourselves. I see myself as my body much more than I see myself as my soul. To me, if you were asked me what is Torchiner, it would be, the image of Torchiner. So if for me to see something happen to myself is a horribly painful experience. So if we're going to do anything that degrades the body, all the more so. And it's bad enough the body deteriorates, but all the more so now. Yeah.
Right. No. But if deteriorating is going to happen either way, whether he's hanging up on the gallows or whether he's buried, it'll be painful either way.
Right. But now we're dealing with doing something further than that. In terms of the guy whose body is left out, suspended, they didn't give this reason. But I'm dealing with, the autopsy issue. You're going to start cutting him up and separating out his limbs. It's a very hard, it's a very hard thing to see happen to oneself. There's that issue. And as a result, because of all of these three things, because we value the body for its contribution in performing mitzvos, and because the body is God's gift to us, and it's God's representative here in that sense, and because of the feelings of the person himself who died, we oppose anything that would be termed in Hebrew nivul hamet, degradation of the deceased. And that's why we, for example, would do the same day burial. This is actually viewed as a biblical prohibition, not to degrade the body. The Gemara in Chulin has a fascinating discussion as part of the issue of execution. They want to know, theoretically, couldn't the defense attorney argue? There are no defense attorneys in Beis Din, but I'm sort of transplanting the Gemara. Couldn't a defense attorney argue that you bring up somebody on charges, you say that Charles shot somebody? Well, how do you know that Charles' victim wasn't already dying? Maybe you should do an autopsy, the Gemara suggests, to determine that Charles' victim didn't have some other fatal illness. Because if Charles' victim was fatally ill from some other cause, then that means that Charles didn't commit murder one, so to speak, to warrant the death penalty. It doesn't mean you're allowed to kill people who are fatally ill or terminally ill. Please don't do that. But the idea is that he's not, the person who kills such a person is not up for the death penalty. So therefore, maybe you should do such an investigation in order to save the life of the defendant. And the Gemara's answer is no. We don't degrade the body of the murder victim. Number one, it's remote, this idea that maybe he was terminally ill. Most people think that or not. But number two, because we don't want to degrade the body, and the Gemara seems to treat it as a biblical level prohibition. Another discussion. Yes?
How does that work out, though? Just because someone's terminally ill, if you kill them directly, you're not responsible for murdering them.
Right. So you are responsible. It's not a good thing to do, and please don't do it. But it doesn't rise to the level of a murder which will warrant the death penalty, not because of lack of intent. The intent is there. It's not like in law the murder-manslaughter distinction. The intent was absolutely there. But what you did was not to end, you did not end a life that was a normal life, so to speak, a life that had a that had some span in front of it. Excuse me. Because this person was what we call a trachoma, this person was already dying, it's not a full-blown life. That's the idea. Does that answer your question, or just push the question further?
Not quite. Basically, when it comes to kill you, express something that you're obligated to.
Right.
Is there a
misophone? I understand.
Right. But that's the law as it's stated, that it's a matter of the nefesh, a full-blown life, being considered somebody whose life did not already have an ending in the immediate future.
We don't give the guy shmishi, you know, we don't take the present for sure.
It's an important point.
Would that sort of come into euthanasia, though?
It definitely figures into the euthanasia discussions, absolutely. Because on the one hand, we're taught that even a moment of life is significant.
You have that on this list? Maybe next semester.
Euthanasia is not on the list, but we could...
Next semester.
Yeah. But on the one hand, we're taught even a moment of life is significant. If it's Shabbos and I can break Shabbos in order to save someone's life, even if just to extend it for another minute, I'm supposed to do that. On the other hand, this person is in a different class when it comes to the life of the person who murdered him. It's presumably part of the leniency of not wanting to kill the defendant, despite the fact that, yes, what he did was to end a life.
So someone's dying anyway, that's the only kind of why it's better to kill them?
If I have to choose between the two?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking? If I have to choose between someone who is a trefa and who's not a trefa?
No, not for the terminal illness. Let's say they're sick or dying suddenly.
Ah.
So it's better to kill them.
Right. So I think not, probably. I'm guessing not, but I'd have to think about that one. I think it's only because it's a trefa where you have a foreseeable end from a cause that's already present. As opposed to, it's just that their cells are going to age at a certain rate and they're out at 70. I think it's more because you have the cause already there. It's a good question. Let me think about it a little more. Does Rabbi Greenberg have your email address so I can email you?
Yeah.
Okay. The truth of the matter is I wouldn't mind sending an email to everybody and giving them the information. So maybe we'll... Whatever. Let me do a little more thought on that question. It's a good question. Okay.
I'll leave it to you.
Thank you.
What are we working?
That's all right. I'll have to write a 7120. I'm not going to forget after that. Okay. Blood pressure. So when you get to the issue of autopsies, this is a major factor. This concern for the honor of the body. Oh, I mentioned there was one other case that we have to also look at, and that's source number 5. This is a must also. It's a story that happened in Bnei Brak, not Bnei Brak today, but Bnei Brak in the days of the Gemara. Think of the Haggadah or Yekiva living in Bnei Brak. That's what we're talking about. So the following once happened in Bnei Brak. A male sold his father's property and later died. Family members later objected that he had been a minor at the time of his death, and therefore at the time of the sale, which would invalidate the sale. You follow the argument, they say he wasn't eligible to sell off the property. They asked Rabbi Akiva about examining the body. They'd like to exhume the body and see whether he was in fact mature or not. Rabbi Akiva replied with two answers. First of all, he said, you're not permitted to degrade his body. And number two, signs of puberty change after death, meaning you're going to pull this guy's body out. He was buried a week ago, a month ago, whatever it was. You're not going to be able to tell necessarily how mature the person was. You don't have enough evidence. Keep that case in mind, please. It's a classic discussion of autopsy in the Gemara, and it's going to matter as we go along. Insurance autopsy, specifically. As a general principle, we have three objections to autopsy. One objection to autopsy is what we just talked about for the first 15-20 minutes, which is the issue of honor of the body. Now, that theoretically can actually be forgiven. And that's a very important point. If you take a look on your sheet, it's source number 6, a quote from the Shulchan Aruch, dealing with how we handle a body. It may come as a surprise to know that the way we bury people today is not the way Jews always buried them. Meaning today, we open up the ground, we dig a hole, and we put somebody in, and we close it up over them, and that's it, that's the burial. However, historically, there were two differences. In the days of the Gemara, number one, they often buried in caves, in the walls of caves. Those were called kuchen. You can see them today. When you travel in Israel, you can see them. So they would bury in the walls of caves in contact with the dirt. It wasn't like a mausoleum where the body is in a drawer. It was in contact with the earth, but in the wall. There's even a discussion in the Gemara Bava Basra about how to maximize the space, how much space you need in between them. There's a weird diagram in Rashi describing diagonal. It's a whole thing. That's number one. And number two is that often what they would do is they would bury the body. They would wait for the flesh to deteriorate so that all that was left were the bones. And then they would move the bones into what was called an ossuary, O-S-S-U-A-R-Y. And it was a box that held the bones of the whole family. So they were, so to speak, reuniting the bones of the family together. I don't know when that stopped. I don't know why it stopped either. But it's not done, as far as I know, anywhere today, including
families
the Middle East.
Belongs to wells.
Yeah, maybe that was the issue. I don't know. But take a look, keeping that in mind, take a look at source number 6. The Shulchan Aruch is made up of two parts. Of Yosef Karo, writing in Tzfat in the end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th. And then Rabbi Moshe Isserles adding his notes from the Ashkenazic community in Krakow in Poland a couple of decades later. So Rabbi Yosef Karo writes, "Ein molichen meis meir sheyeshba kavaros leir." Acheres is added. It's not clear whether that's part of the original text. Elam ken michutz laaretz laaretz. He says you can't move a body from a city with graves to another city. Someone died in a certain city, and there is a cemetery. You use it. You don't take the body somewhere else, other than from outside Israel to Israel. That's the only exception. Already in the days of the Gemara, people were doing this. They would die outside of Israel and have their body brought. And the Gemara says, better to go there while you're alive. But nonetheless, if you didn't move there while you were alive, that was something to be buried in Israel. So the Ramah, Moshe Isserles, adds, or to the place of one's ancestors' plots. Meaning, if a person dies in Florida, and their entire family is buried in Toronto, you would be allowed to move the body from Florida to Toronto, even though they have cemeteries there. Nonetheless, reuniting a family is considered to be a meritorious thing. Why? Because people want it. And this adds in the subjective element. Because this is something that people care about, therefore we are justified in doing that move.
What about from Israel to Toronto?
So, again, going back to this, it will be a subjective thing. In other words, if a person were to instruct, I want to, then we would do it for them. He says, continues to say, if he instructs them to transport him or to bury him near his home rather than in the cemetery, we listen. Then he adds a separate note, which is very important for us. One may place lime on him to hasten decay of his flesh and enable us to bring him to the place he instructed. You would actually be allowed to do things to hasten deterioration of the flesh, that the bones could be reunited with the rest of the family. So that's very important, because it cements for us the idea that a lot of our concerns for nivul hameis, for degrading the body, are subjective. So let's say somebody does what the Chasam Sofer discussed. Somebody wills his body to science. So now, are we able to do it? Because, you know, don't tell me about not degrading the body. He's fine with it. Would I be able to do so? So there are two other considerations that come into play. One is delay of burial. We are taught that we're supposed to delay as soon as we possibly can. No, we're supposed to bury as soon as we possibly can. Some debate as to whether it's biblical or rabbinic. It's learned from that case of the execution that we discussed. I see that it's 108, so I'm going to rush a little bit just to make sure that people who leave at 115 can get a solid piece out of this. So the rule is that we don't delay, and not only that, this is not subjective. If you take a look at the second side of your sheet, the Rambam writes, eulogy is an act of honor for the dead, and so we force heirs to pay for eulogizers to eulogize the deceased. If he instructs not to eulogize him, we don't do it, right? Meaning I would listen. If someone says, I don't want a hesped, I don't want a eulogy, so we don't eulogize him. However, if he instructs that they not bury him, we do not listen. For burial is a mitzvah. The Torah says, you shall bury it. That's the case of the person who was executed, from which we understand that that burial overrides the instructions of the deceased, including for delay. So even if he says, I don't want you to bury me for a week, I want you to leave me in state in the Capitol building or something, doesn't make a difference. We bury immediately. So if the autopsy is going to delay the burial, which it normally does, that's a reason not to do it.
And you also not wait for family to come in?
So for minimum family, we do wait, because that's considered the minimum criteria for burial, is to have the family come in, meaning immediate family, those who would be obligated to mourn. There are leniencies also for grandchildren for the sake of the abelim, for the sake of the mourners themselves. But I had a case where somebody had passed away. He had no immediate family. He just had a nephew who lived in another state. And the nephew said, well, you know what, tomorrow I'm having root canal. Can we push it off until Sunday? So I told him, look, we're burying with you without you. I wasn't having any of it. Thank God you came in. That's ridiculous. Anyway, but the third issue, which I'm going to minimize because it's not as real an issue for us, is the issue of Isur Hanah. The rule is that you're not allowed to benefit from a corpse, as a general rule. The Gemara I brought you there in source number 8 is the source for it. I'm not allowed to benefit from a corpse. So you could argue that I'm not allowed to autopsy in order to learn things from the body because you're not supposed to benefit from it. However, that's not so. The Tzitz Eliezer quotes the Machane Chaim and the Har Tzvi, Tzvi Pesach Frank notes as well that the benefit of looking at the body to learn something is not called benefit from the body. That's not what he's talking about, and that's the trend among most halachic authorities. So the reasons to prohibit, again, would be honor of the deceased and delay of burial. The benefit one is not such a concern. On the other hand, there are two arguments to permit. Number one, pikuach nefesh. If you have an ability to save somebody's life, there's a person who is ill here, and I might learn a lesson about how to treat him from an autopsy on this person. So would I be allowed to autopsy for that purpose to save someone's life? The answer is maybe.
Organ transplant.
Organ transplant is another piece. The reason why it's a maybe is because of source number 9, which I'm not going to go through in depth, again, in the interests of time. But the rule is you're not allowed to save yourself using somebody else's assets. So that really what you're doing is you're saving this person, not directly, but indirectly, by learning something from somebody else.
But we've already decided that isn't benefit.
Right. So the question is, would this be called benefit? Or would I be concerned about doing something negative to this person? It's not about benefiting from him as much as it is degrading him in order to save myself. So that's the potential concern. And the other is, you don't actually know you're going to save someone's life. You don't even have a reasonable doubt, unless there's a body there. There's somebody there, a patient who's ill, and you need to learn something. Let's go dig this guy up, and now be able to autopsy him. Normally, that's not the way it works. The exception to that would be the case in a family where you want to diagnose and see if there's a congenital illness that the siblings need to know about. So then you would have a case where you would say, yes, we actually need to autopsy to save their lives. Because you need to know, is there a hole in the heart? Is there something else that's going on? The other reason to be lenient would be, potentially, I mentioned before, if the person forgave it. If the person said, I want to be autopsied, I want to will my body to science, I want you to open me up. Yes?
I just wanted to ask, I don't know if you're going to talk about it, but what do you think of the body exhibits? Like, this seems to be like...
Body Works.
Right. So the Body Works exhibit is, from my understanding, a real halakhic problem. Number one, these bodies are not being buried. We have a direct mitzvah of bury somebody. Number two,
does the matter not true of the body? Like,
right, so that's an interesting question. Is there an issue of a mitzvah to bury them? We do. The Gemara Gittin says that we are supposed to take care of non-Jewish bodies also. We are supposed to bury them as well. But where a person explicitly, where a non-Jew explicitly said, I don't want to be buried, then we would not have a mitzvah of go ahead and bury him. However, the issue is still one of degrading the human form as a gift from God and as a representative of God here. I'm very uncomfortable with the exhibits.
There seems to be like mixed...
Yeah? I guarantee you on any given topic there are mixed opinions. Right. My general understanding is that we don't encourage it. Certainly for Kohanim, it's a separate problem. But even for non-Kohanim, we generally don't encourage people to see it. That's my understanding. Your mileage may vary. As with all practical issues, I say, please ask the rabbi of your shul. It's his problem. In practice, what do we do? So, in terms of autopsies for medical knowledge, we generally avoid it other than in the case of determining the presence of a genetic disease or where you have an immediate patient right there. In the case of a body that's willed to science, So the Chasam Sofer and the Maharam Shik were against it because of divine honor. The Binyan Sion, the Tzitz Eliezer, said if he wills himself to science, it's actually permitted. Because they're only concerned about degrading the body, and that's subjective. And a person can say, I forgive it. However, even those who permit, like the Tzitz Eliezer, also Rabbi Sion Uziel, who was an early chief rabbi of the State of Israel, even those who permit it don't permit it open-ended. In other words, it's not that you can use this body's, you know, use the body for medical students for the next 20 years. It's only immediate use, followed by burial of all parts, which is the same rule that we apply where the law requires it for a criminal investigation. So we say they can do whatever they have to do immediately and then bury afterwards. If you take a look at the sheet, you see the in practice section. So there I gave you the guidelines that are used often and are given to coroner's offices for how to do an autopsy. And you see there the concern about expediting release of the body. They use a body pouch to make sure that no part of the body is lost. Everything will end up being buried. You try to suture everything. The Sacred Society in Source 9 is also known as the Chevra Kedisha, the people who take the body after burial. You want to have some representative present to make sure that the body will be treated with proper dignity. That's basically the autopsy topic before we get to cremation. Anyone have questions?
Cadavers.
Right, so the cadaver is part of this discussion, right? We try to avoid.
We're going to take a 3 minute break. If you have a 1:30 class, if you don't mind, it's about now. And part two, cremation.
Okay. The cremation discussion. So the same reasons that applied regarding autopsy are going to apply regarding cremation. Nivul Hames is one, degrading the body, as we talked about. However, worth noting that just as we said, a person can waive the concern for Nivul Hames in terms of other issues, they could also waive it on cremation. They could say, well, that's okay, I don't consider this degrading to my body, and that would be permitted. There's a second issue, though, which is that if the body is burned, it's no longer a body, halakhically. For issues like purity and impurity, for example, once it's been reduced to ash, it's no longer a body. As a result, you can't fulfill the mitzvah of burial anymore. Even if you take ashes and put them in the ground, that's not called burial. Yeah.
As soon as the body becomes ashes, what happens if you have a burn victim? What do you do in such scenarios?
So, burn victims generally are not reduced to ash. In cremation is a specific process.
So as soon as they become, I guess, cremated.
Yeah.
But if they're burned, then it's still okay.
Right. And what about... Right.
I'm not saying we don't bury ashes. I'm going to get to that. I'm just saying that it's not called burial when you put ashes in the ground.
Therefore, there can be no mitzvah of the victims of the Holocaust?
So there's no mitzvah of burial. That doesn't mean we don't bury them. But it means that you didn't fulfill a mitzvah of burial when you're dealing with that. Someone's body's been reduced to that state. Since you're not fulfilling burial, if someone says, I want to be cremated, he's really instructing me, don't fulfill the Torah's mitzvah. The Torah's mitzvah is bury him. And the person is telling me, don't fulfill it. So the general rule, when someone says to me, don't fulfill a mitzvah from the Torah, my answer is no. So as a result, I wouldn't be allowed to cremate that person. This creates all sorts of problems. Because what do you do when someone gives instructions and says cremate, and you're the relative who is supposed to be carrying things out and taking care of things? Can you go against the person's wishes? So those things are very much handled on a case-by-case basis. I'm familiar with one case in which a certain person, I wish I could use the name, because some of you actually may know the family, but it's because of that, I can't use the name. But it is a real character. A certain wealthy Jewish family where a member of the family had insisted on being cremated. And so the person's aunt said, okay, you can do what you want, but I'm going to pay for a full burial first, and then you can, if you want, you can exhume the body and cremate. It's going to be on you to actually do that. But I'm fulfilling my mitzvah of burial, which is not a cheap thing to do. But it's a very difficult situation. Like, you're telling me that I'm required now to go against their last wishes. They wanted to be cremated. They told me they wanted to be cremated. Yeah, it's very thorny and it's handled case by case. A third reason why we avoid cremating is because it's often done as a denial of belief in Tchiyas HaMeisim. Now, I want to be very careful with this, because after Amy Winehouse died and was cremated, there was an article on CNN's website saying that Orthodox Jews don't cremate because they believe that a person's body has to be restored in the ultimate resurrection, and God can't resurrect the person if the body is not intact. It's a joke. I mean, it's absurd. The body deteriorates in the grave. How would anybody even think that? Not only that, we talked about adding a line to make the body deteriorate. So yeah, the answer is they consulted somebody, some expert on Judaism, who had no clue what he was talking about, and they published it for the world to see. That's not what our issue is here. The issue that the Beis Yitzchak was raising, and the Sfirei Eish as well, raised this, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, is that often the motivation for cremation is a negation of the body and a negation of the importance of this world, and a statement of my life is over now and there's nothing for me afterwards. And because we don't want to encourage that, it's certainly not something that traditionally we buy into. Therefore, we don't want to cremate a person. We make a statement of things do still go on, things do still exist. We don't simply destroy the body and that's the end of it. So those three are the reasons why we oppose cremation: degrading the body, which again could theoretically be waived, the our mitzvah of burial, and the issue of what we believe in. We believe in Tchiyas HaMesim, we don't want a person denying that. So we avoid it. What happens if they come to the Chevra Kedisha and say, as happened to me, we want a Tahara done even though we're going to be cremated? The relatives believe that Tahara is important, maybe even the deceased believe that Tahara is important. And Tahara is when the Chevra Kedisha washes and cleans the person for burial and puts them in the shrouds that we use for burial. So, would we do that for a person? So, the answer is... Sorry?
Is that a mitzvah?
Right. So, it is under the general issue of Kavod HaMeisim, honoring the deceased,
as part of showing honor.
Right, so the specific steps are not. The specific steps are minhag. They're associated with all sorts of Kabbalah-oriented elements. There are, the number of times that we tie the belt and the shape of the letters that we tie the knot in the belt, things like that. That exists, but the specific steps are just the ways that we fulfill the overall mitzvah of showing honor to the person who passed away. So the authorities generally, the poskim generally say not to do the tahara. They say that all you're doing is conveying a message that cremation is okay. Because look, they're even handling it with Chevra Kedisha. I will tell you from my own case knowledge that often the Chevra Kedisha will do it anyway. Because of a concern, on the other hand, making sure that people respect Chevra Kedisha and Tahara, meaning you're often dealing with a case of someone who's coming from a community where they don't, in general, understand or embrace Chevra Kedisha rituals, so that even when they're burying people in the ground, they won't go for Tahara. So there's this sort of imperative of, I want people to go for a Tahara, so therefore I'm going to do it whenever somebody asks for it, to make sure that they're aware of Tahara as a practice. It's a very tricky issue to be dealt with case by case with a posing. It's not simple and straightforward. The last question is burying the ashes in a cemetery. We said there's no mitzvah of burial for ashes, but on the other hand, does that mean that you can't bury them? There's no obligation to bury them, but what about beyond that? So this is dealt with by many halachic authorities. Unfortunately, it came up a lot. It comes up a lot. As early as the Melamed Lahoil, writing in the middle of the 19th century in Germany, Rav David Zvi Hoffman, and down till today, has responsa on it. The Sfirei Eish has two responsa on the issue. So we want the ashes to be set aside and stored somewhere, because we don't want anybody to benefit from the ashes by accident. I mean, frankly, they don't want to either. We want to avoid somebody using the ashes in some inappropriate way. And there is no prohibition against burying these ashes in a cemetery. As a matter of fact, a firstborn animal is supposed to be a karban. It's supposed to be brought as an offering to God, unless it gets a blemish. But other than that, you're supposed to bring it as an offering to God. At some point in Jewish history, it's not clear to me when they were doing this, but you find it written up, they would actually bury a firstborn animal after the Beis HaMikdash in a Jewish cemetery. Because it had special sanctity to it, and you weren't allowed to benefit from it. So they would actually bury it in the Jewish cemetery. So when they write about this issue, they say, well, if you can bury an animal in the Jewish cemetery, you can certainly bury the ashes in a Jewish cemetery. On the other hand, the opposite concern is the same one we have with the Tahara. The more I do that is routine and normal, for this person's ashes, the more I convey that cremation is just another Jewish option. We're doing everything else the normal way, so it must be that cremation is okay. And because of that, again, authorities have been loath to permit the burial of ashes in a Jewish cemetery. One thing that's often done to deal with it is to bury them right outside the cemetery. So we are putting the ashes away. We're treating it with some modicum of respect. But on the other hand, we're showing this isn't the main Jewish cemetery because we don't cremate. That's what we're trying to convey to people.
What's defined as out of the Jewish cemetery?
Look, Jewish cemeteries tend to have gates around them, and right outside the gate would be sufficient.
But could you still bury with, like, I have a feeling like a lot of the lesser observant cemeteries or of lesser observant shuls that have cemeteries, but sure they bury cremations next to their loved ones.
Right, so the...
As well as sometimes non-Jews.
Right, so Reform, I'm speaking from the U.S. because that's really my familiarity. Reform in the U.S. buries cremations in the cemetery itself. Conservative is mixed. They often have problems because they generally charter their cemeteries 50 or 60 or 70 years ago at a time when cremation was not done in the conservative community as well. And therefore they wrote up charters for their cemetery saying no one who's cremated will be buried here. And that's what they told all the people when they wrote it, when people bought plots. It was in the contract. And the problem now is that they want to bury, I had a case like this, I was consulted on it by a conservative community who wanted to know, now what do we do? Because now they want to accept. They want to bury ashes in there, and their problem is that they told everybody they wouldn't, and there's a sense in the cemetery of, I only want to be buried with people who conform with my standard, whatever my standard is, which is its own discussion, a fascinating discussion in its own right. So in the end, they ended up saying, you know what, we're going to do it because we believe that there's nothing wrong in burying it there, and we're going to go ahead and do it. This, therefore, it didn't have to be specified in the contracts of all the people going back 50, 60, 70 years. So in that case that I'm familiar with, they decided to bury there. But it's an interesting problem.
Wait, so how did they change? Why did they justify if they're breaking the contract then?
Because they said we're not really breaking the contract since it was legal all along. It was legal to bury them in this cemetery anyway. It's not called burial. Therefore, it's okay. That was their argument.
So they sort of dodged around logic.
I don't know. I wouldn't put it down exactly because you find the concept in contract law in general. You can say this wasn't mentioned in the original contract, but that's because no one cares about it. It isn't significant. Here it's harder because it actually said in the contract we will not bury them.
Right. That's
right. No, I understand what you're saying. I wasn't particularly happy, but I wasn't their posting. They just asked me what I thought. Those are two different things. But that's the general rule. So to summarize, on the cremation point, we don't do it. We definitely avoid it because of degrading the body, because of the mitzvah of burial, and because of the emunah issues, the faith issues that are involved. We avoid burying them in the cemetery, even though technically there's nothing halakhically wrong with doing it itself. We don't want to encourage cremation, so we bury outside the cemetery. And in terms of doing a tahara, again, we try to avoid doing the tahara, but there are competing concerns that might well justify it. Thank you very much.